Stations, everyone. This is ATCS, my name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this Weimar Festival Net every Sunday night at 8 p.m., so it's still a little bit over 11. So I hope you're all seated and running your radio and microphone and ready to participate tonight. As always, I like to remind people that if you cannot reach the repeater, talk to us via radio. You can reach me via email, either for mailbag questions or topics of interest, or to share a puzzle or two with us, or if you would like me to poke a ball on the shoulder and have to take a look at a video or YouTube or something story in space and or NASA related. The mailbag email address is mailbag@ATCS.com and mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. I maintain a nice list of links. The first few links are either visual, not really lend themselves to discussion on radios, or they're space related, so all will be taken up the Space Net report with many of these similar stories, so I just keep the links available. And the bottom portion are links to articles I found interesting. If I have time for the science talk segment, will be featured in them. But you can read them by yourself. They're all available there, and they'll stay there for months, if not years. The link is inside the browser, roy.ac2cs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. We have a TechNet chat room. You can either go to Weimar's own website and find the link and click into it, or you can just type into your browser, chat.ac2cs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. As always, I try to stream the audio of the repeater, so if you have friends that do not have access to a radio or they're beyond the listening range of our repeater, just have them type into their browser, technet.ac2cs.com, and most of the time they will be listening to a stream of W2CL's repeater. Always want to remind you of MyKC2NJI has a wonderful archive of past technical nets going as far back as September 2006. That's available at a great website, which is amateurradio.tv. So please avail yourself of it. It has contained within it the wisdom of many brilliant guys in our hobby who unfortunately have become silent history. But their voice and their wisdom persist in the archive. So please avail yourself.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, never a good sign. Apparently I timed out the repeater, so I hope you figured out most of the stuff. Nothing particularly new. Also, want to make a comment. I took in all WS2N presentations this Wednesday night at the meeting of the explaining the ISS. Fascinating talk, and my understanding is it has been recorded and hopefully will be available club members and non-club members alike in the future, so I look forward to that, and please avail yourself of that as well when it becomes available. Let me drop for a second and I'll give you our schedule for tonight. Okay, the plan is, Andy, WHSCDL has a little bit of traffic at the top of the technical net. And we will ask for people if they have any questions or topics of amateur radio technical nature. We'll put them on the list and we'll try and get to them in an orderly fashion. If we have further time, I will probably regale you with the story of what the heck happened to my radio last Sunday night. If you were paying attention last Sunday night, I lost the ability to receive anyone. I could transmit on my ICOM 7100. I could not receive anything. It was giving me this weird hum and a click that locked up my menu system, and hardware resetting it did nothing to help it. So maybe I'll tell you about that story, and we'll ask for any more broad-based science-related questions as well. Or sometime around 10:15, all comes up with the SpaceNet report, And that'll take us to about 11 p.m. I'll come back, tie a bow on it, which will, and that'll be it for tonight, if the repeater and my receiver and my radio are all willing. With that in mind, Andy, if you're out there or you have a little bit of traffic at the top of the tech net, please share.
Okay, very good. And this is Lucky Week. Hey, all to everyone, on a little bit earlier than scheduled. I did call Roy and I told him, due to some personal issues and other things, and obviously it's also the summertime, I'm going to be postponing the East Corner portion for part of the summer. I'm going to be very busy here in the next few weeks in June, and I got other things are going away in July for a couple of weeks anyway. Okay, and because of that, I'm going to postpone the, or put off the, Andy's Corner for a while, but I plan on coming back. I know I'm going away also in the late part of August, I'm going down to a flea market, at least I'm planning on it anyway. So I'll see you guys sometime in the early part of August, and we'll go from there. So that was, that's what I want to say. So, it was fun, and it'll be fun again, but the winter will come back, and during the winter months, we spend more time indoors than outdoors, as hopefully everybody else does also, especially now that the pandemic is calming down. Hoping that more people get together and family and do other activities. So that would be good too. So thanks, Roy, and everybody else, and yeah, we will be back. Still planning on it. But for now, we'll just postpone it for a while. I'll let Roy know when I'm coming back, so he'll make the announcement. Thanks, Roy. Back to you. Back to the TechNet, WHCCM.
Well, thank you, Andy. You're welcome back whenever it's a good time for you. I look forward to future editions of Andy's Corner in general, and especially the Technician's Corner, where you discuss how you think through problems and figure out what's broken. That's a very fascinating topic, and I'm sure everyone is looking forward to it. So I wish you well this summer. I wish you an enjoyable time, and nothing bad, and have fun. And you're always welcome back whenever time is available to you.
As some other people said, thank you very much. I will be back. I will be back campaigning in 2020. No, that's the wrong thing. Wrong thing. I guess I'm just taking an excerpt from a from somebody that said something at one time. But as Arnold Schwarzenegger said, I will be back. Thanks, Roy.
You're very welcome, Andy. So we start this segment as most. If anyone has any questions or topics that they would like to discuss or follow through or problems mentioned and then solved, this is a good time. Hit that push to talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
This is Raymond at KD2DYY, and I have a question.
Raymond, recognize anyone else out there? Okay, I'm not quite sure. It sounded as though someone tripped the repeater, but there was no audio. So if there was a second person out there, rearrange your antenna, increase your gain if possible, check your mic line, and give it another try. Okay, perhaps some people will come a little bit later. Raymond, you're up first and only. What's your question for tonight?
Oh, thank you. I feel so honored. I'm basically a newbie at the hobby, and I'm starting to set up my radio. And one of the things I had to question is in the 23 centimeter band. The receive frequency and the transmit frequencies are offset. But in the repeater book, shows it at an offset of a minus 12, but yet the frequencies they're showing are offset by a 20. Is that an error or am I misreading something?
Well, there are standards for different bands, but they're not laws. So you should pretty much go by the repeater listings that are published for a given repeater for the offset. Theoretically, VHF is supposed to be a 600 kilohertz offset, but there are some 1 megahertz offset repeaters out there. So if you have any kind of contradiction between the standard rules of a band and the information given on a reputable repeater list, I would always take the reputable repeater list.
All right, well, the repeater book has the frequencies for, like, Glen Oaks at 1288 megahertz as a receive, excuse me, and a 1268 as a transmit. So, but yet it's reporting that it's a minus 12 megahertz offset.
Okay, that's very confusing. I've never really played with 23 centimeters. The 1200 megahertz band. Anyone out there, especially the guys who are in charge of it, I'm sure you know the offset for that repeater. Any suggestions of what's going on here? Gosh, no one out there either uses or runs the 23 centimeter club repeater. That's a shame. Give us one more try. If anyone out there has any experience with our own little 23 centimeter repeater, if you know what the actual offset is, apparently there's some contradiction in the records on that matter. Well, Raymond, I don't know what to tell you. I'm kind of surprised that we couldn't get anyone on the repeater who has knowledge about that. Have you taken a look at the club's own website? There's a page that has the repeaters mentioned. Perhaps they have better numbers listed there.
Yeah, I did go to the club's website to take a look at it, and they're only showing the receive frequency with an offset of minus 12. So I guess I'll play a little bit this week, and hopefully I can report back to you guys next Sunday what I found out.
Okay, very good, Raymond. I mean, I would just try to use that first and see what happens. If it fails, then you could always try the alternative, but I would try the published result.
All right, well, thank you very much for trying it, Lee.
Okay, very good, Raymond. I wish you luck, and please come back and tell me how things turned out. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My name is Roy, and this is Hawaii Mark Technical Mess. So please, if you have any technical questions or subjects or results of things that we discussed earlier or your own findings on something that you'd like to share, please hit that push to talk button.
KB2DX, please.
Yes, KB2DXC. What's your first name, sir?
Okay, then first name is Phil. That's Papala Hotel, India, Lima. Copy.
Yes, indeed. I have it, Phil. What can I do you for tonight?
Well, I'm trying to troubleshoot an issue with an NFED long wire antenna that I use by HF. I have a problem with unexplained change. I've got like the SWR has gone off scale, and I've done all my troubleshooting as far as on the coax and the antenna tuner, and had my bird meter up there. I had my dummy load up on top side to check things out to see if it wasn't an issue with the coax. And I believe I eliminated that as any issues, but the NFED long wire antenna has a 9-to-1 balance manufactured by myantennas.com. And I was wondering, is there a possibility that that balun and the circuitry in there has gone south on me? Back to you. Back to Ned.
Well, yes, it can. Balun can overheat. The ferrite can be either reversibly damaged when it cools down, or if it's brought too high a temperature, irreversibly damaged. So the first thing to do is check that the balance rating hasn't been overloaded. You know, if you go look at the balance and you see that it's set for, I don't know, 50 watts, and you've been throwing 100 watts with something that's full duty, like data, some of the newer Joe Taylor data modes that are 100% duty cycle, you can burn out the ballast. Another thing is, I haven't quite heard anything about the counterpoise. When you're using something like an NFED, you're going to need some kind of counterpoise, be it a individual wire that's just kind of hanging loose, or a wire that's grounded into earth ground. All things being equal, if you don't supply any of that, your system will attempt to use your transmission line in common mode as a counterpoise. That's not usually the best approach, because that introduces RF into the system. If you then choke it, an RF choke, it'll get rid of that problem, but it will give you a bigger problem in that you do not have a counterpoised NFED radiator. So just as a question, what kind of a counterpoise, if any, do you have presently installed in your NFED?
Well, presently I do have like a 15-foot length of like 14-gauge wire coming off the grounding nut on the balun itself. I'll give you a little bit more description of my setup. Really, is that my antennas are on the roof of a 5-story apartment building. I am on the second floor. It's about 100 feet of coax run. I do have a choke filter on the line up at the antenna, just below the just before, of course, the balun. Once again, I do have a counterpoise on the roof. About, like I said, like a 15-foot piece of like 14-gauge wire laid out. Nothing fancy, nothing robust. And I have an earth ground at the my MFJ window pass through that goes to a ground rod another story below me. So that's what I'm dealing with right now. And it's just very sudden. And interestingly, aside from the SWR going low off the scale, on frequencies that I was never resonant on, even with the tuner, it's now resonant like on 15 meters, like, you know, 1-to-1, and I never had that before. KV2DXC, back to net.
Okay, that's quite interesting. So did anything change between the time period where it was operating reasonably and suddenly stopped? Was there any lightning strike, any weather change? Did you put a choke in where there wasn't a choke? Anything that kind of differentiates the two stages?
Well, the only two things I can think of is, one is that we have had some heat, lightning, and the like in recent days. The other thing, well, I was up on the roof just doing some preventive maintenance and putting on some wire ties to bundle some coax. It was the only thing I've ever touched before I started having the SWR.
Okay, what did you connect the wire ties to?
Oh, just wrapping a bundle of my coax, got two, you know, LMR 400 runs, and I wanted to just put a couple extra wire ties on the mast so that it, you know, relieves some strain. And yes, the first thought I had when this problem came was maybe I nicked something, maybe I loosened the connector. I did my due diligence and brought my dummy load up to the roof, put the antenna, the coax to the dummy load, and went back down to the shack. And, you know, with and without the antenna tuner and with my bird meter, I was getting one-to-one, so I don't know if I can assume that telling me that I might have eliminated any of the coax as an issue.
Well, I would think it makes it incredibly highly unlikely that it's the coax problem. The only problem you could get from coiling a coax, you kind of discuss the false belief some people have that if you have excess coax and you coil it up, you increase its inductance and increase its standing wave ratio. It doesn't work like that. But if you do tightly coil it, you can disturb, depending upon what the insulator material inside the coax does, you can press the center wire off center and disrupt the impedance to a degree, and that might lead to some problems. I wouldn't assume that you really tightly coiled it. You just kind of secured it with the wire wraps, and the fact that you had tested the dummy load seems to work. Is, you know, would indicate that it's probably not that. So it's good to have a VNA. We've talked in the past that some VNAs are dirt cheap these days. I don't want to push products, but the nano VNA, I think, goes for $50 to $80, depending upon the monitor. And you can even do something called time domain reflectometry. So if there is an impedance mismatch along the line of the coax, it'll reflect it back and tell you exactly how far to go before to look for the damage internal to the coax. So nice toy to have. I don't know. Based by what you're telling me, you haven't changed position. You haven't changed wires. You know, wires, as long as they're connected, should work. The only thing that strikes me as a possibility is that you might want to swap out the balance for a known brand and see if that gives you any particular benefit. It's possible that something happened and it just heated up too much and you didn't realize it, and it changed the quality of the ferrite balance, and therefore the balance isn't quite working up as specs and giving you a strange frequency characteristic.
Okay, well, just to clarify in regards to the coax, what I did up there, I didn't have anything to do with any coils. It basically was a straight section, just, you know, up to a mast, and I wasn't messing with coils or tightening anything. Yes, and I did use, I had an MSJ antenna analyzer, I used that, and yeah, things were a little bit all over the map from the shack, but went up on the roof, everything didn't line up too well either, so I don't know, I'm tending to think that, you know, through the process of elimination, that the balance either took a static zap. My radio usage is very light duty, so I can't imagine my over. It's rated, the antenna, by the way, to my antenna, that was like for a 1,000-watt one. It's their 1,000 or 1K. My antenna is N-fed long wire. And that's what I've used, and it works well. I'm going to let it drop. Maybe there is somebody out there that might have some wisdom. This is KB2DX.
This is KB2DYY with a comment.
Yes, Raymond.
Sounds like a problem I had with a standard pole antenna.
Everything worked up great up to the antenna, and that's where it dropped off. So I took the complete antenna apart and actually found it was a GP98 antenna, which is a tri-band, and I found several of the segments were poorly soldered. After I re-soldered everything, I got back to a perfect antenna.
Okay, Raymond, that's a good thing. Some antennas can be poorly manufactured. The feeling I got from Phil that it's a very, very simple N-fed. It's a single piece of wire. It goes into the ballast, and that's about all that it really does. I mean, if I'm wrong about that, please, Phil, correct me.
It's that simple. And my antennas makes a series of, they have N-fed half waves, and I went with the N-fed long wire antenna, and I think they come in different lengths, 44 feet. I've got the 53 foot one, and they can go even larger. And it's as simple as that. I did open up the ballon while it was still up on the mast. I didn't really have an ability to take a really close look at it yet. I didn't see anything that was obvious. I don't know, a static zap doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to see a scorch mark inside the box, so I would have to probably, you know, dissect it a bit, do a little further research. I don't know if that's really worth the time to do that. I should just, like, you know, look at just getting another antenna set up or another ballon to replace with that. This is KB2 DXC.
Oh, BDH, you can comment. Yes, BDH. Fine. This is WA2BDH. I had a problem one time with my R7 vertical, and what it was, the toroid had a fracture in it, but it was hardly noticeable. You really had to look very closely to see that the ferrite toroid in the matching box for the R7 vertical had a fracture. Only when I looked very closely, I found it, and I had to get another matching box for the R7 vertical. So take a very good look at those toroids in the ballast there. Okay, that's very good advice, John. And even if there are not any visible fractures in the ballast, it is theoretically possible for ballast to overheat and fail, and they don't usually leave scorch marks. It's a very subtle effect that changes the nature of ferrite. Ferrites are mixtures of different oxides, and by heating them with the binder, you can disrupt the structure that they're designed to. It shifts the entire characteristic of that particular balance from one mix to another. So, although John has very good advice in that it's possible that you'll find a very, very small fracture in it that's disrupting it, there are other ways for balance, unfortunately, to fail that are far less obvious.
Yes, I was under any other impression that, you know, it doesn't take much sometimes to throw things off balance. I was just trying to figure out if it was something I did that day. I was doing my, you know, wire tie wrap thingy, that I might have tugged on something too hard or something, but through a process of elimination, I think it's come down to the antenna, but, you know, I still can't get off to get wrap my head around. If I didn't hit it with a hammer, how could it break? But we're talking electronics. This is KB2DXC back to net.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, Mother Nature, the second law of thermodynamics, the entropy always increases. So if you give the universe enough time, it will break everything that you own. So although there is not a demonstrable reason why it fails, that would still tend to be my most likely suggestion to you, because pretty much done away with the idea that the coax transmission line is problematic, the way that you tested it. There's not much that can really go wrong with an N-fed as long as the wire is still connected to the ballast, and that would still tend to be a problem with the ballast if it's not electronically connected. So there's little levels that can go wrong. Now, if you're satisfied with NFEDs, then certainly I would invest in another ballast and see what happens. If you want to be experimental and try a different technology antenna, that's, another option. You mentioned the different type of NFED. One NFED is a half wave. It's an interesting idea. The half wave, the benefit is that if you operate it at a half wave, you don't really need to bother too much about a counterpoise because it's just an NFED half wave dipole. It will have an incredibly high impedance because the lowest impedance of a dipole is the center, where it's about 73 ohms. But as you go farther and farther, it goes higher and higher. At the edge, it approaches something like 3,000 ohms. That's why usually a 49-to-1 ballast is used to reduce the impedance to a range where an antenna tuner can do something useful. A non-half wave NFED is a little bit more forgiving because it doesn't have that, usually that high 2 or 3,000 ohm impedance at the end, and that's why only a 9-to-1 impedance transforming balance is required. But, both work under slightly different circumstances, it's up to you. If you're happy with the design, try another ballast. If you're curious about other designs, might be a good excuse here.
Okay, it's KV2DXC. Well, I'll tell you, I've had other antennas. I've had, I think it was like a Cushcraft or a Comet, a rotatable dipole, multi-band, which I had it in a fixed position. It looked pretty sad after a couple of years. Also got to keep in mind that not a lot of mounting points on the roof of an apartment building. I have my mast attached to vent pipes, substantial vent pipes. I wanted to be low-key, and that's why I chose a wire antenna this time around, and I think I went with a long wire antenna, the NFED long wire, simply because it gave me the right length where I can have my mounting points, one end, the other end. It's really difficult for me to do a wire dipole with my setup and not be low-key or something along those lines. Back to that.
Okay, I mean, that's reasonable. I mean, that's one of the major selling points for NFED. You only need to deal with 2 points of installing. Although I've recently, other tech nets that I listen to on the West Coast, this gentleman was actually using an NFED as an inverted V. He was mounting it in three positions just to give that orientation rather than a straight one. But generally speaking, NFED's great benefit is one less mounting point. Regular centered dipoles require three. I tend to be a fan of band dipoles, but if you don't have the distance for them, when you don't have 3 points of mounting, then endpoints can be very, very useful. You have to be cautious about proper counterpoising them because it's very easy to get RF into the deck. As you mentioned, you have an RF choke, which is pretty much necessary for most people using NFEDs. Otherwise, you're going to have computers rebooting and lights going off and on in your chest.
Well, that was a slight issue that seems to have come and gone in the past day or two, where I was getting RF feedback into the speaker of my 736R when I was doing 6 meter work, and I never had that before. And then I don't know what I did; it disappeared. So that was giving me a slight problem with that. Also, before I had these antenna problems, when I got on 40 meters, forget about it. Anything I had a speaker in it, this one's screeching. But let me just go back a little bit now with between the NFED long wire versus NFED half wave wire antenna. Pros and cons between those, please.
The half waves are very measurement specific, whereas the non-specific, non-resident allows for picking any particular length, and some people have their favorite length. Again, some people, a lot of people usually do not operate them as half-wave antennas because they're only half-wave antennas that aren't multiples of the length of the wire, which is not too much. So a lot of the times that people are using so-called half-wave antennas, they're sort of using them in the mode that you're using yours, and having to correct for the excessive impedance transformation at the ballonet. So probably it's somewhat more efficient to simply go with a 9-to-1 and as a random size NFED, unless you actually do cut it down for particular bands where it's a half wave, and then it's more beneficial for those specific. But as a multi-band, I would think that a non-resident NFED would probably be more efficient.
Okay, nothing. Well, I'm going to wrap it up in a couple of minutes, but while we're on the subject of antennas, and one of the projects I was going to go into in the near future was to purchase a remote antenna tuner. Right now I have on my desktop the LDG Z11 Pro automatic. Works like a charm. I like it. It's a little noisy, but I've heard that actually to have the antenna tuner at the antenna point is the best place to have it. So a question of mine is, what should I not put between, let's say, the bias T and the antenna tuner, such as maybe a choke, you know, a choke filter or other types of accessories and things? What can and can't, you know, go between or actually fit in such a setup where I'm using a remote antenna tuner?
Okay, an external antenna tuner is a very good idea. Antenna tuners are something that people argue almost all the time on HF over. There is a contingent of people who think it's simply a fraud. You're either fooling yourself or the final stage of your transmitter that it's a 50-ohm impedance when it really isn't, on one side. And on the other side, people who love antenna tuners wouldn't work without them and don't have anything kind to say about the other group. As in most cases, it's somewhere in the middle. The problem is that an antenna tuner will correct impedance mismatch, but it will not stop the degree of reflection back and forth going from your antenna mismatch to your antenna tuner that will match it. So what happens is RF doesn't make a straight line to your antenna. It tends to bounce back and forth a bit. And every travel that it bounces is attenuation loss of an average coaxial cable. What some people do is they replace the somewhat lossy coaxial cable for an open line, which has far less attenuation loss. So it may do the same number of bounces back and forth, but the losses per pass will be decidedly less. Another great solution is to simply move the impedance regulating the hardware directly at the feed point as an external antenna tuner. All things being equal, they're auto tuners that have a control device sometimes and that are weather proof so that the water doesn't get into them. You shouldn't have any problems, as far as I understand it, because if you have a bias T supplying power to it, if you're sending signals through it, you're sending it through the central line, which is shielded from external situations. But if you put ballast all over the place, if you put RF chokes will only increase the impedance of the common mode current on the outer aspect of the coax shield, and the data flowing to your antenna tuner is inside that. So it should be properly fielded. So you don't have to worry about it as far as I understand the concept.
K82VXC. Well, I was concerned that if I say I have the, you know, the choke filter, which I've also bought from my antennas, would interfere with the IST passing its current through. But from what I gather, what you're telling me, that should not impact the operation of the IST and the remote antenna. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't use a balance that are impedance transforming because those require RF frequencies to pass the signal. So, in other words, your 9 to 1 or a halfway 49 to 1 would be a no-no. But anything like an ugly balance or a bunch of ferrite clamps, the one after the other, a standard RF scope that isn't involved in a transformer operation should be fine.
Well, currently right now I have one of those inline RF chokes. So you're telling me that should not be used if I'm using a remote antenna tuner?
Well, it sort of depends upon what the nature of the inline. The usual designation for a coax with a couple of ferrite chokes next to each other and then wrapped to something, I think the standard one is named after the designer who is W2DU. Do you know exactly how the RF choke operates?
Okay, well, I am familiar with the W2DU, but please, continue. Expand.
Well, it's just what you were really looking for in way of an RF choke is something that's going to choke the common mode on the outer aspect of your shield. You don't want to use something that has a transformer in it, even if it's a one-to-one transformer, because that's going to block DC current, because DC current doesn't pass through transformers. So it will act as a block for the power source, which I assume is DC, that the bias is going to insert into the coax cable. So you need something that's simply going to increase the impedance of the outer aspect of the shield. Again, that's usually either tight loops of coax itself, about 5 or 6 turns, about 6 inches in diameter, if the coax is capable of sharp turns like that. That's an ugly balance, or a multiple clamp a set of ferrites that are locked in, and I use a heat shrink tubing to fasten them in that area and weatherproof them.
That's an excellent idea. I like that. So I actually have it on the exterior of the coax as opposed to inline, because I just heard you say that RF choke filter could block the DC current. Did I hear you correct?
Only if it's a transformer. In other words, you open up the balance, that's a transformer. There's probably at least one, if not two, ferrite rings. There's loops of wire going from the input. There's loops of wire going to the output. That configuration would not pass the DC current for the signal for an external antenna tuner. So you have to have a RF choke that doesn't use any transformers as part of their design.
Okay, I think I got that. So it's transformers. Okay, let me let it drop and see if anybody else has any questions. Sounds like it's a quiet night on that. Okay, I got some research to do, and I'm going to open up that 9-to-1 balance, give it a really careful eyeball, and possibly do a replacement.
Okay, very good, Phil. I wish you good luck, and please come back and tell us what you found so that you can add to our body of knowledge here.
Yeah, I most certainly will do that. I will most certainly check in, give you the updates on that. And of course, after I hang up here, I'll probably think of a thousand more questions. But I'm going to turn it over. I think I've had enough for the night. I think other people may or may not have some questions. This is KAB2DX, be clear. I'm listening out.
Okay, Phil. Good luck with that. And I hope you're right that there are other people with other questions. Once again, this is AB2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this, the Limewalk Technical Net. So please, if you have any questions, if you have any topics, if you have any comments, if you've discovered something, you'd like to share it with the rest of us, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, it's going to be one of those nights, I guess. Let me share with you a not so long, but not so short, story of what happened to me last Sunday night as I was talking on the Limewalk Technical Net. And some of you listened last week might have heard it. All of a sudden, I was transmitting. I let go of my little push-to-talk trigger that I use because I use a headset for the microphone and headphones. So it doesn't have to push the talk, so I have to trigger finger this device. I let go and heard nothing except for some humming and some clicking. And I was looking at other radios, and there seemed to be an audio signal coming from them, but it wasn't coming from my ICOM 7100. So that was confusing. I tried turning it off and turning it on, you know, like they tell you to do with computers, and that didn't help. I tried rebooting it. I tried setting it to a partial reset mode. I tried setting it to a factory full reset mode. It was still out in a very strange way. Rather than hearing anyone's signal, I would hear the slight hum and the click. I could get rid of it by raising the squelch level enough to quiet it. I also discovered that when that noise was going on, if I tried to hit the menu button, I couldn't get to the menu button. The screen would flash like it was the menu button, but then flash back to the previous screen. If I turned up the squelch, which killed that little noise, I was able to get to the menu. And also, people were telling me that when I was squelching, my audio sounded much better than when I wasn't squelching my audio. So that was deeply confusing. Let me drop for a sec. By the way, I will put some pauses in with enough time that if anyone wants to either ask any questions or add something or suggest something or tell me that I did something rather foolish, so be it, but I will leave you those little pauses. So, what ultimately happened after trying those things, I wasn't going to disconnect and try and fix the radio during the technical net. So what I ended up doing was I was transmitting on my ICOM 7100, and I was listening on one of my other radios. You might ask why I didn't just transmit on the other radio, because this was the only radio that has a amplifier that throws 150 watts at the Limewalk repeater, which is necessary right now until the new antenna comes in, gets put up. So, nevertheless, I was talking on one radio, listening on another radio. After the show is over, I started to do some detective work. I wanted to know whether the reception was only VHF or something else. So I tried UHF. Same exact problem. Then I wanted to know, because the ICOM 7100 has some things in common, both UHF and VHF, but a lot less in the HF portion. Pretty much separate. So I tried it on HF. Same exact problem. So it was happening on every mode and every band. So I couldn't imagine why it would be the receiver portion, so I then veered off and said, it's probably the amplifier. The audio signal from the detector is somehow getting disrupted and leaving me with this weird noise. Maybe something has blown and perhaps a capacitor that is grounding RF is no longer grounding the RF and it's blanking the audio proper and also somehow getting within the CPU. Let me drop for a second. Okay, let me try again. Anyway, so I was kind of stuck with that idea. So my gut feeling was that maybe something was blown in the 7100. They're all surface mount devices. I don't have any equipment to test it for the most part. I don't have any equipment to remove it. I don't have any spare parts. I don't have any equipment to solder surface mount. So, bit of a problem. I decided to throw money at it, which some people do and some people don't do. So I bought a new 7100. It was on sale at CX Engineering for $800. It seemed like a good price, and it's always nice to have an emergency radio. So I got this new radio. I pulled the old radio out of all the wire connections, replaced it with the brand new radio, turn it on, and the same problem happened.
WS2M?
Yes, Paul.
Okay, I've tried to transfer a couple of times. Now I'm on high power. I wonder if there's an issue maybe. Check your receiver on this repeater. I was wondering if you had any noise at all. I mean, could you go over to like the weather, you know, on NOAA? Try that. I wonder if you experimented doing that. I mean, there was just dead quiet on the receive.
Well, it wasn't exactly dead quiet, but it was not anything that would be perceived as a received signal. WWV, I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't hear even static or noise. All I heard was this kind of very, very, very low intensity hum and this occasional erratic, untimely click noise that every so often would come out of the speaker.
Okay, I'm sitting here trying to think of things I would think of. If that was the case, I'd say, well, maybe the volume control, you know, was scratchy and you weren't getting anything. Okay, I'll let you continue on, Roy. You got me.
Yes, indeed. Well, if it was a volume knob thing, there would be a whole bunch of different characteristics as far as I can see. If I, welching the audio shouldn't have any effect on the CPU. On getting the menu up. The menu is a completely different thing, and, you know, usually when you have a signal, you can call up the memory. When you don't have a signal, you can call up the memory. So that was confusing the heck out of me. So I swap out the 7100. So now I know that there's no component in the 7100 that's malfunctioning. So something else is malfunctioning. So the only thing left really are connectors and what the connectors are connected to. So I think to myself, what is the most likely thing to really give a confusing presentation? And I kind of hit my head and said, obviously, there is the way that the ICOM 7100 is, for people who don't own one or haven't seen one, it has a face and is connected to a scroll head via an Ethernet cable. It's an RJ45 Ethernet cable. So I said, maybe my cable malfunctions and it's just not sending right signals and it's spewing noise and other stuff. So I ran over to my shielded Ethernet cable replacement place, plugged in a replacement. Didn't change anything. Yes, Bill. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, when you were still on the net and you were operating two radios simultaneously, were they on different power supplies?
No, No, they were not. They were on, not only were they on the same power supply, but I had them hooked up to my kind of emergency bypass power supply. It's a power gate, so if the utility had shut off, it would have swapped over to my lithium iron phosphate. But they were both hooked up to the same exact battery supply, getting the same exact voltage. And I even played with the voltage setting.
Yeah, roger. Stumped. Back to this.
Okay, so let me advance this murder mystery even more. So I fried out an extension, a control cable to the command front piece, and it didn't help at all. Then I thought to myself, as I mentioned, I'm using this radio, among other reasons, because it's hooked up to a RM Italy LA250 linear amplifier to get 150 watts of power into a Weimar per meter. It has this nasty tendency that I noticed when I had plugged it into my West 6700 prior to this. It has a built-in preamp that you cannot turn off. If you put it into standby mode, it still operates the preamp. The preamp is a little bit noisy, so what I was seeing on my TAN adapter were these very low-intensity spurs, at regular intervals. They were not enough to cause any kind of reception problem, so it was just an ugly-looking thing when I looked at my TAN adapter, but I knew that they were there. When I put them into the ICOM 7100, which has no TAN adapter, I didn't see them, so I was upset with them that much. But I knew they were still there. So I said, maybe it's the preamp sending something back into the radio that both of these radios don't like. So I bypassed the amplifier entirely. I hooked up the output of the ICOM 7100 directly to my transmission line going to my antenna. It didn't help at all. Well, that kind of left me a little bit confused. I was kind of running out of things. In addition, the back of the 7100 has an accessory connection. The accessory connection is used for a bunch of things. I was using it to control an expert linear amplifier for HF work. It does a bit of handshaking with the amplifier and allows me to tune and do other things with it. As I said, maybe that's doing it. So I disconnected it. It didn't help at all. Okay, so run out of things to disconnect. Disconnected the USB connector. I'm thinking to myself, maybe something in the USB hub is just sending random data bits and confusing the heck out of the CPU. So I disconnected the USB connector, and guess what? Nothing changed. So at this point, I was really getting particularly frustrated. I was sort of running out of things to disconnect. So I decided to basically pull everything from that box other than the power cord, just for the heck of it, see what happens. I pulled them all, and all of a sudden, it started to work. So finally, I figured out which wire was doing that. There's a little wire at the edge which was connected to a connector that says, was labeled, microphone. Keep in mind, I do not use a microphone connection on that component. My microphone, my headset, is connected through the control front end, which has its own microphone input. What I was using that microphone input for was simply, I was running two pins, which was the push-to-talk control. So it was the push-to-talk control that was doing all of this. Apparently what was happening is I have a series of Y connectors spread out the push-to-talk state. And so a piece of flotsam apparently got into the Y connector and apparently offered my CPU, who apparently is the thing that's